I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The city is a reflection of its people, their beliefs, their skills, their relationships. Our guests today are working in very different areas to improve the city by improving the lives of the people who live there. Dr. William Pensoff is the president of the Family Institute at Northwestern University. His work with the families of Chicago includes tough advice to parents on how to ensure that their children thrive in the big city. Stephen Antupit is creating new neighborhoods in the city of Seattle that are socially, economically, and environmentally sustainable. We'll talk about making healthy cities with Dr. William Pensoff and Stephen Antupit today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. William Pensoff is president of the Family Institute, a clinical professor in the Department of Psychology at Northwestern University, and the director of the Center for Applied Psychological and Family Studies at Northwestern. He teaches in the Master of Science in Marital and Family Therapy program. Dr. Pensoff is a licensed clinical psychologist and licensed marriage and family therapist. Bill, you may be the first practicing psychologist we've had on our show, so welcome.
Thank you.
To what extent are the problems of families reflected in city life?
I guess I'm not exactly sure what that means, to think that the problems of families are reflected in city life, in the sense that families are so much a part of cities and affected by the organization of cities, and in some ways, I'm not sure that families so much shape the cities. In fact, it seems as if there's a reciprocal interaction between cities and families and that they're shaping each other and influencing each other.
What are the most common problems you see in family life?
Well, you know, I think that there are a number of common problems. I mean, I think that the Family Institute, the place that I work, deals with families in the Chicago area, and we deal with different kinds of families in different contexts. And we work with on the one hand, the wealthiest families in Chicago, and on the other hand, we work with the poorest families in Chicago. And I think that the issues that they bring to the Family Institute or to any kind of mental health organization are different. I can talk about kind of the different groups. I think We work fairly extensively with poor African-American families in the Chicago community, and they're struggling with a variety of problems, dealing with how do you keep your kids safe, how do you deal with gangs and violence in the community, how do you make sure your kids go to decent schools and get a decent education, and insofar as we work with those families, we are trying to address those kinds of struggles. There's also, obviously, drugs, which is an issue that actually cuts across all social classes in this country, not just in the cities. And I think everybody's worried about how do you keep your kids safe in terms of those kinds of threats. You know, I think that, on the other hand, if you look more at kind of upper middle class white families in Chicago, I think what we tend to see is families presenting with a lot of marital problems, problems concerning divorce. We're a major center for treating couples that are having marital problems, and so a lot of people come to us with that. And I think today there are a lot of challenges and stresses on marriages. There are a lot of issues that didn't really exist 50 years ago in terms of threats to marriage. And so I think many, many people are struggling with how do you maintain a vital marriage, particularly as we're living longer, and you think about a marriage as a relationship that's going to last 50, 60 years. How do you maintain a relationship and keep it as a kind of living, vital entity over that period of time when you're raising kids, launching kids, dealing with older parents and how you help them, and then struggling with both your own the deterioration of two people who are living together and committed to each other. And that's a kind of rough set of challenges over many, many years. So that, you know, we see a lot of that. on the other hand, the other thing that cuts across all socioeconomic and ethnic groups and racial groups and cities are the issues of mental illness. And about 20% of the population of the United States at some point is going to experience a clinical depression at some point in their life. And that's obviously one out of five people. And I think that there's probably not a person that you're going to run into who has not been depressed or doesn't know somebody who has been depressed. Anxiety is also a very common disorder. There's there's various forms that the anxiety disorders take, dealing with phobias and kind of general panic attacks and things like that, and those are relatively common as well. Similarly, I think addiction is a huge problem that afflicts families, again, not just in cities but across the entire country, and the issues of how do you keep your kids safe from drugs and alcohol, how do you deal with partners or parents who are struggling with alcoholism or drug addiction. And these are the kind of issues that we end up seeing all the time. It keeps us busy.
As a poor parent, how do you keep your child safe from gangs?
Well, it's very, the research literature suggests that basically parents who in a poor urban environment where gangs are a major issue and there's a lot of antisocial, violent behavior in the community, that a fairly authoritarian parenting style that very closely monitors the kids, that keeps them focused on the pro-social or the good kinds of things that they should be doing in terms of studying, sports, doing other kinds of social activities. I think churches also can provide a very meaningful context that can support school activities and other activities like that. I think that the other thing is frequently kids get into gangs when it becomes a solution to a social problem. They get into drugs when it becomes a solution to an emotional problem. It's a way to cope with anxiety, a way to cope with depression. And I think that to whatever extent parents can be sensitive to kids that are struggling with anxiety or depression and try to avail themselves of mental health services in their community that might be able to address those things before the kids can turn to drugs or alcohol or gangs. The other big issue, and I think this is a very good thing that's going on in the country, it's problematic, but overall I think it's a very good thing. A bunch of research came out in the 1990s that pretty much said that you could have a very strong family, but if the community is too poor around it, that the strength of the family can't resist the forces in the community that will get kids involved in gangs and drugs. And particularly if 40% of the community was above the poverty level, what these researchers found was that that having a good, healthy, strong family with committed parents who were very engaged in monitoring the kids, it didn't matter. They couldn't resist the force of the community around them. And in many ways, this research has led to a good transformation in public housing philosophy. And as I'm sure you know, in Chicago, they've torn down the Robert Taylor Homes and Stateway Gardens and Cabrini Green, these very famous, if not infamous, huge housing developments that concentrated poor people in a very restricted community. And the idea is to rebuild these areas with mixed housing where there's a percentage of the people who were in public housing, but they're basically integrated into a mixed community. And I think that in those mixed communities, families that in other contexts would not have power to really influence what happens to their kids will have power to influence what happens to their kids. Parental control, parental involvement, parental monitoring, things like that can make a big difference if you're living in a community that is not too impoverished and too decimated in terms of a whole variety of, you know, the services that people need to live well.
You said that you advise a fairly authoritarian style of parenting. You said that that has proven to be effective. Tell me what's going on there.
Right. Well, let me just clarify. I wasn't advocating an authoritarian parenting style across the board. I think what I was saying is that in very poor communities where there are a lot of risky options that are available and enticing the children, that the research literature suggests that a more authoritarian and engaged parenting style, not necessarily a punitive, harsh style, but an authoritarian style, as opposed to more laissez-faire, that the kids tend to be safer and do better. I think if you take an upscale community where you don't have those kinds of social and economic and criminal risks, I'm not advocating an authoritarian parenting style. I think that there's been a movement in the United States, and I think this has also been the case really in Western Europe as well, and in general in Western civilization, to move away from corporal punishment with children or physical punishment. And most psychologists and child development people recommend timeout, and I think timeout is a very useful thing, that basically you remove a child from the social environment for a while. However, part of what we've run into in working with some Latino families and Latino communities and with some African-American families and African-American communities, there's a sense almost if you don't hit a child, you're not being a responsible parent. And that's not saying to beat a child, but to give a child a swat on the bottom, and that is being a good, engaged parent. And in Sweden, if you do that, you'll be arrested. but in other communities. And so, I mean, part of what we struggle with in terms of providing mental health services that are family-oriented to families that kind of cross the socioeconomic and racial spectrum, how can you do that in a way that's culturally sensitive to the things that they value and think are important? And, you know, I think that in general I don't recommend hitting children. I don't think it's a good thing. But I think in certain situations, parents may feel it's the right thing to do. And if you're working with them and you're going to have any credibility with them and you say, don't hit your kids, they're going to look at you like you're crazy and you don't know what you're talking about.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dr. Bill Pensoff. He is president of the Family Institute at Northwestern University. Talk about the other end of things, though. Obviously, well-to-do parents, again, seem to have less control over their children in public than they have had in the past, and seem to think that is the right way to handle them. Is it the right way to handle them?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's going on in our society, it's going on in our cities, it's going on in our suburbs, it's a kind of, in some ways, an empowering of children, which there's good things in terms of that, but there's also a downside to it in the sense that kids feel like nobody can tell me what to do. I can do what I want to do. I need to speak up in all situations. And there's a kind of abdication of parental authority. And, I mean, it's interesting if you go to France and you're in a restaurant and kids are there, you never see kids acting up. I mean, it just doesn't happen. You'll even get 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds who behave appropriately in the restaurant, whereas it's much more common here to be out and to see kids who are talking back to parents, who are being defiant, who are being disrespectful, and that the parents act as if they're helpless in the face of that. And I don't think that's good for the kids, and I don't think it's good for the parents. And I think that in many ways parents feel guilty today because there are many, many families are dual-career families. Kids are in daycare. Kids are at school all day. And that you have limited time, and there's a sense of making up for not being with them enough. The other thing is about half of the kids in urban settings are living in remarried families or divorced families. So there's a sense of one or more parent is going to feel like I don't get enough time with my child. So the time becomes so precious, the child becomes so precious, that there's a kind of suspension of normal rules of conduct and normal expectations. And I think that's destructive for the children, and I think it's destructive for the parent-child relationship. And these kids end up with a grandiose notion of I can do no wrong, and I can say whatever I want to whomever I want. And they then run into big trouble when they get out into the world and assume everybody's going to treat them the way their parents treat them.
Mm-hmm. Your colleague Rebecca Hoffman and I were talking recently about the way we interact with the city and our fellow citizens, and we were laughing about her willingness to confront people who litter. It reminded us both that good behavior needs to be, and good public behavior needs to be encouraged. If you were mayor of Chicago, how would you encourage good public behavior, knowing what you know as a clinical psychologist?
Well, it's a great question. It's a really tough question. I think that, for one thing, I would make mental health services much more available to people and do everything I could to kind of destigmatize them, in the sense that if people can go meet with a marital and family therapist or a psychologist or a counselor, and it's easy, it's not stigmatized, it's something you can do, that it's as if it's almost like meeting with a family doctor who can be available when you need them and you have a problem. I think that that's, you know, one of the things that I would do if I were mayor, really increase the services that are available and accessible, I mean easily accessible to people, kind of take the hassle out of that. I think that the issue of teachers having authority and responsibility over children, I think, is a really important thing. And the holding parents responsible for children's behavior in public. And I think if children behave in a way that's antisocial, inappropriate, disrespectful, that the parents should be held accountable for that behavior. At times I have worked with families from different kind of ethnic backgrounds, and with certain families, there's a sense that every adult in the community is, in essence, a parent of the child, and that you must respect everybody. And I think that that's a really good philosophy. How you communicate that, I mean, again, I know that the mayor's power is limited and my power as mayor would be limited, but I think that the empowering of adults is very, very important. But on the other hand, the nurturing and caring for children is as important. They need to go together. I mean, one of the things, again, that you see in Europe, they have a wonderful daycare for children. When children, if you look at the, in Western Europe, if you look, for instance, at the food children are given in daycare and in schools, it's healthy food. It is usually prepared in the school. It is fresh food. It is not junk food. They do not have Coke machines. They don't have candy machines. It just doesn't happen like that. And in many ways, they care more about their children and take better care of their children than we do. And I think that in this, I mean, we, on the one hand, kind of indulge our children, and then we kind of neglect them on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And I think that it doesn't make them good citizens. It doesn't do them a service to do that. And I think that we need to take better care of our children as a society, particularly in our cities. I think, you know, there is a movement. I mean, one of the things that my wife has had a huge impact on me, she's a transportation planner, and she specializes in bicycle and pedestrian transportation. And if she had her way, everybody would walk to work or ride bicycles, and we'd cut down on the use of cars 40%. What that does is that creates environments in which children can move about easily in a community. And they're not afraid to cross a six-lane road. They have time to do that. They can ride their bikes. They can walk. And one of the good things is there are more and more spaces in cities like Chicago that are being created as kind of pedestrian zones and that are bike-friendly, where there are bike lanes. It's still, there are many bike lanes that are terrifying to ride on because you've got cars zooming by you all the time. But I think to create urban environments where people can move about, particularly where children can move about safely and where we're not privileging automobiles and but creating human environments is another way of saying people are important. They're more important than cars,
mm-hmm.
and that we have to create spaces for them and that kind of privilege them. And I think that the more we can do that, and I think there is more and more of that being done, and it's terrific, but I think we need to do a whole lot more. When you go see cities like Copenhagen and Stockholm, where this is the norm, kids are safer, they're happier, they can get about in their communities with less fear, parents are less frightened about kids being out in the community. And they create urban spaces that are just much more inviting and safer and that take care of people better.
I want to stick with transit just a minute and go back to this question of public behavior. If you were riding a CTA train and you were in a car where some 14, 15-year-olds were being loud or being boisterous with one another, or let's say they even throw down a cup. It's back to the village concept. I mean, do you speak up?
It depends. I think, of course, my inclination would be to speak up. If I thought that it might put me physically in danger or somebody else physically in danger, I probably wouldn't do
mm-hmm.
it. I might take out my cell phone and call the police and say that something was going on. I might look for a conductor or a motorman but I think it would really depend on the risk of that moment. My inclination would be strongly to say, you should stop that or you should pick that up. And, you know, I think more adults need to do that and adults need to support each other if they do that so that there's a sense of we're together in this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that typically, my inclination would be strongly to speak up, particularly if I felt that there was no physical risk involved.
And I want to come back to your bicycling example, because it seems to me that we've created a society, for the most part, where children have no freedom, and then they have complete freedom. Until they're 16, they have no freedom. They turn 16, they can drive a car anywhere. And it seems to me gradual freedom makes a lot more sense, and perhaps we'd have fewer kids killed on the highway with drunk driving, as there seems to be an epidemic of that. What's your feeling about it seems like cycling and even transit would create those sort of interim independent opportunities. Is that good for kids?
Absolutely. I mean, for one thing, I'd be for raising the driving age to 18. I mean, I think that to have kids in high school driving cars is dangerous and unnecessary. Particularly, one of the things I think that is where cities have it over suburbs is kids can get around in cities without an automobile. If you live in the suburbs, that can be much more difficult. But kids in the city can take buses, they can take subways, they can take, they can ride bikes, they can walk, and it's much easier. Kids that grow up in suburbs, particularly these very large developments, they frequently can't cross a road safely on a bike or walking, and they have to be driven everywhere. And my experience in working and knowing families in Chicago versus families in the suburbs of Chicago is that frequently the kids who live in Chicago may not even get their license when they're 16 because they really don't need a car, and that they're more involved. They would be, you know, taking the subway, taking the bus, and using public transportation or riding their bike or walking. And I think that that's a much, much healthier alternative and a much safer alternative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this weekend, I know a couple of kids were killed in Deerfield, a suburb, and they were drunk and they were driving. And, you know, I think every year you hear about that happening a number of times in the suburban communities. It doesn't happen as much in the cities because the kids aren't in cars as much. And I think that that's a much healthier environment. This is where I think the cities have it. Kids are safer in cities than they are in the suburbs in high school.
Bill, this has been a good conversation. You won't be the last practicing psychologist that I have on the show. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Sure. Sure, pleasure.
Dr. William Pensoff is president of the Family Institute at Northwestern University. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Stephen Antrepit about his experience in building sustainable neighborhoods in Seattle. And we'll talk to Otis White about One City's formula for going hip. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Okay, Otis, you are now saying we should be taking lessons on how to make places hip from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. What's going on here?
Well, we talk about, you know, you and I talk about, most people talk about big cities all the time. That's sort of our frame of reference when we talk about urbanism. But, you know, there are a lot of small cities out there that are kind of catching this sort of urbanist bug as well. And one of them is, of all places, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And what Harrisburg has that's sort of distinctive is a little restaurant district downtown that has become sort of the talk of the region. And the local paper in Harrisburg tried to figure out recently, why was this little area, this portion of downtown, such an exciting place to be and was obviously thriving and all of that? And it came up with six factors that helped feed into it, but there are really three of them that are probably worth touching on. One of them is that the restaurant owners, and again, this is called Restaurant Row in Harrisburg, the restaurant owners figured out that people wanted to be around other people. So they congregated. Now, if you think about it, most restaurants would sort of say, well, we want to be away from our competition because they'll take our business. But in fact, what they found was, as one of them put it, people like to watch people. And another one said, a crowd draws a crowd. So if we locate close to one another, it'll begin to draw that crowd, and yet more people will come there. So first of all, they figured out that congregating was a really good strategy. The second thing was that they enhanced this crowd environment by installing some architectural details that really helped. One of them was these large rollout windows that when it's nice weather, they can actually open the windows to the restaurants, and it's like the sidewalk and the restaurant merge. And so the people in the restaurant can look out on the crowd can look out on the restaurants. There's a lot of excitement that goes sort of in and out, and it simply builds the excitement and the novelty of this area. And the third thing that happened, the newspaper pointed out, was the city didn't mess it up. And the temptation of cities to mess up really good things is enormous, Carol. Some, you know, might have reacted to those crowds by being a little panicked. I mean, there's noise, there's always litter that's there. But the city figured out that we got to take the bad with the good, and in fact, there's a lot of things we can do about the bad. So they were very diligent about picking up the litter after these evenings, and they put cops on horseback, which enhanced the feeling of safety in the downtown and also helped a lot with crowd control. Not that crowds were ever necessarily a problem there, but there were just a lot of people on the streets in the early morning hours. And the city did one or two things that were very positive, one of which was they simply permitted sidewalk dining so that the restaurants could actually move outside and onto the sidewalk. Again, you know, the temptation of cities to mess things up is enormous. They not only did not mess things up, but they enhanced it because they realized that the objective was to get folks to come to the center city in the evenings, and this Restaurant Row was accomplishing all of that.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist with Governing Magazine. Stephen Antrepit is with Seattle-based Methune, an architecture, design, and urban planning firm building its reputation on sustainable practices. He previously worked in the public sector where he conceived and executed a master developer strategy to engage market-rate production home builders in Seattle's three award-winning Hope 6 projects. Stephen, what motivated you to move the sustainability question from buildings to neighborhoods?
as far as the environmental challenges that we face, for the longest time, it's been apparent to many of us that cities are really the answer and that we have to really look at a big comprehensive scale of what's happening as we're making and remaking our cities and the neighborhoods in our cities as a positive force in the global environmental question. So green building has been around in a couple different ways for a while. I've come to this work actually from a city planning perspective. But in terms of remaking neighborhoods, ones that have not been socially healthy or physically making a good contribution to water quality or quality of life for the people that are surrounding those neighborhoods, it's really been a process of sort of bringing up the scale and integrating the natural forces that are, you know, so important on all of our lives, but for quite a while haven't been the ones that we look at a neighborhood level. They've been really much more at the building level.
You said that cities are the answer, and that's obvious. Tell me why.
Well, because there are so many things that can be done more efficiently in an urban setting than in a spread out, sprawled fashion. I mean, cities are the most complex invention really in human history, and they're organic and they're flexible. But cities also are the places where ideas can develop and new solutions can come together, whether they're about social issues or about how to use resources efficiently. And so to be in one place where things are happening is more efficient. And that's, you know, there's technical parts of that, but there's also a social element. You know, what we can do to preserve productive farmland and forests and natural areas, that we have to, you know, reduce the pressure on those areas. And the way we do that is to make civables terrific places.
Tell me what makes neighborhoods or cities sustainable.
Well, there are several different dimensions. There's the social human dimension. There's the physical processes, the natural processes. There's that dimension. And then there's the economic dimension. So that's why, you know, that's why sustainability has so many syllables, because there's so many parts of it. So I'm going to talk about High Point as a neighborhood in those three different dimensions. And High Point is a neighborhood in Seattle that's 120 acres. And it's the site of a former public housing project that was originally built for Rosie the Riveter during World War II as defense worker housing. And it was designed to last for 5 years through a production push where folks that were working night and day building bombers and armaments would come home to. And the idea was it was part of a war effort. Well, that was in 1941 that it was built, and it wasn't part of the basic fabric of a Seattle neighborhood. It was clearly an imposition, and it was a product of an emergency effort, and it wasn't intended to last. Well, after World War II, this property and other locations and neighborhoods around it were turned over to the city of Seattle and said, well, here you go. You know, we're done with this. Do what you want. For a while, it was an important resource for people migrating to the cities, for returning veterans, for families that were in transition at the post-war economy changes. But it wasn't intended to be a neighborhood for the long term. It was an artifact and wasn't a functional place for the people who lived there or the surrounding community. So High Point's redevelopment really has been about bringing it back into part of West Seattle, making it a positive asset for the natural systems in Seattle, and to be economically viable for the people who live there and for the owners, which is the Housing Authority, City of Seattle. So a redevelopment project really took on the social, the natural, and the economic dimensions of what High Point could be. And the first phase is almost complete, and it's a completely mixed income community that in itself is impressive in terms of its scope and its attractiveness to people. But not only that, it's because it's 10% of a watershed an urban watershed for a salmon-bearing stream within the city limits of Seattle. It's a very important piece of the puzzle in terms of the regional economy and the natural health of our urban environment. So when the planning work really got started, it wasn't just about the people who lived there and what they saw their future is and what they felt the neighborhood should look like and how it should function, but also to say, if we're going to remake this place in this scale, which is, you know, quite unusual in its scope and breadth, you know, what else do we need to do? And it was really the city of Seattle's vision pushing to say, you know, if this is 10% of a watershed, it has a real impact on the quality of the water that those salmon rear in. And what can we do to make it better? And so a lot of the design framework really was in response to the water and the fish and the people that live there. And so how do you put those two together? So those, you know, those were some basic principles going into it. And now it's a neighborhood of people on a very modest means, of no means, people on disability, people that are refugees, public housing tenants, mixed in living across the street or across the alley from people who have decided to buy a house there, a market rate consumer choice of upwards of $500,000 to buy a house in Seattle in this neighborhood. So they're all living there together. They're neighbors in West Seattle. And the way that the neighborhood actually fits into the Longfellow Creek watershed is that through a comprehensive natural drainage system, there are a series of swales and other design elements that clean, slow down, and keep water cool so that when it leaves the site and it gets to Longfellow Creek, this portion of the site appears to the fish or to the measurements that you would make there on the behalf of the fish, that this portion of that urban watershed really functions as if it were a mountain meadow. So it's the water that comes off of High Point is not like stormwater full of grease and particulates that comes rushing down off of streets and through drains. It makes a different contribution to the urban ecosystem.
How did you make that happen?
Again, partly it was the leadership that said, if we're going to make this kind of reinvention of a neighborhood, let's think outside the box.
Mm-hmm. But what about at a technology level? I mean, what are the methods or the building methods?
There are specific techniques and design approaches that are part of that. And this natural drainage system picked up on ideas that have been used. They've been tested, some in Seattle, some in other places. Sometimes it's materials. It varies from things that like porous pavement has been around and been used in several applications. In certain parts of the country, it's much more common. But here at High Point, there's the first porous pavement street, a public street that looks like gray Rice Krispies, but water actually goes through it. It doesn't sheet off to the side and go swishing down the gutter. It actually goes through the pavement and into the soil below. Well, under that porous pavement street, the subgrade is basically engineered to then take water toward a system of the bioswales that includes the right mixture of soil amendments and the biological action of microbes and the roots of the plants that are planted there to clean soil and clean the soil so that when stormwater comes through there, it's better than as it was when it landed on the pavement. So the bioswales, the porous pavement, those are all connected around the perimeter of every block of this 120-acre site. They lead to a pond, which is actually part of a park. It's not a detention pond. Looks like a little lake. Water comes in there and then it is slowly released to Longfellow Creek. This was basically a green infrastructure that was put together with the design team working with the city to say, let's do this differently. Partly to test it, to see what pieces could be replicated in other neighborhoods. Obviously, in a city like Seattle that's built out, there aren't places where there is a whole 120-acre redevelopment site that you get to start over again. But there are pieces that could be and have been taken from these systems and done elsewhere. So, you know, it's the porous pavement on the street, or maybe it's in a sidewalk on a block that's being, streets being rebuilt, or where there's room to do a swale and how that's planted so that it slows water and cools it and cleans it, and then it may go to a drain pipe or it may go to a creek. You know, there are those elements, you know, at the level of each house that's built, there are certain things that are done. The downspouts that come off, you know, the gutters that come down from the roof, they don't go into a pipe, they go into a little a splash block. Actually, an artist was commissioned to design several different beautiful little cast concrete splash blocks, and the water flows across the ground before it gets to the swale. It's not thrown into a pipe and then, you know, off to a treatment plant, because it doesn't need to be treated. It just needs to be slowed and kept cool enough that it can function like natural stormwater. So there are other things. There are rain gardens and there are collection swales. There are actually some places where stormwater that's collected off of roofs actually pops up. It looks like an irrigation riser, but it's actually stormwater that's just then getting distributed around on a lawn area. So that's on the water side was an important piece of it. And actually, was tied very carefully into the design of the new neighborhood by preserving a number of mature trees. I think there were 105 mature trees that were assessed in terms of their health and their longevity. And to save those, they're worth about $1.5 million. And to be able to design the neighborhood and the new streets around saving those trees and the natural drainage system was presented some exciting design challenges, but it literally roots the new community in the past because there are all these new homes, new streets, new folks living there. But the mature trees that have been there 50 and 60 years are, again, part of the armature of nature in the city. So those are things that are visible as you walk around. I think what you wouldn't see as easily, but as perhaps even more important to folks that live there, both low-income folks and people who are buying houses at market rate, are the energy efficiency commitments of the new neighborhood. In fact, the rental homes at High Point in the first phase, I think there are just around 300 that are all Energy Star certified, and that's the biggest chunk of Energy Star homes produced in one place. So we're very proud of that, and it makes a big difference. There's also an interesting program at High Point that deals with indoor air quality. So that's a sort of it's not uncommon in green building considerations on indoor air quality. And actually, through a longitudinal study that is partnered with the local public health department, there's a Breathe Easy Home program where very comprehensive approach to materials in construction as well as landscape and reducing to the extent possible, eliminating allergens from the environment around these homes. There's a series of families who are part of this longitudinal study to combat childhood asthma and looking at using the new construction of these homes that don't off gas, that don't collect dust, that don't have pollen from male trees, et cetera, putting those things together as a package in a public health benefit. So, you know, it sounds like an experiment, and it is, but it's also a functioning neighborhood with houses that have front porches, cars that don't overwhelm the street because they're parked behind or off the alley, narrow streets that feel comfortable for walking so that there's, you know, people are encouraged to walk, close nearby services. There's a library, a health center, a neighborhood retail area that's under construction. So all these things together are part of a livable community.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Stephen Antupit with Methuen in Seattle. Let me ask you about porous pavement. I can imagine sitting through that RFP and the road contractor saying, well, what do you mean? This hasn't been tested. I can imagine the public works guy saying, this hasn't been tested. I'm going to have to do more maintenance. Who's really going to cover the cost? I can imagine all of the hurdles that you must have faced when you specified a fundamentally different kind of pavement. Tell me about that and how you overcame them.
Well, there's two things. One, it's not the very, very first time it's ever been used. Hadn't been applied in a public street in the state of Washington. So this was kind of an increment. There are contractors that will do your driveway that way. There are, you know, golf clubs that have parking lots that are, you know, so it's out there. It's not the market standard, but it's out there. Really, what it comes down to is that the public utilities, which is a city-owned utility, said, you know, there's this comprehensive vision for how this neighborhood can work, and the streets are a big part of that, and this is really important to us. And in fact, they paid the difference between what a standard street would have cost and the extra engineering because it was, you know, triple over-designed to address all those things you just, you know, asked about in terms of public works and maintenance, all the rest of that. And they paid the difference for that, saying, look, we need to have a real street that we can walk on, that we can have people drive over and see how it is in 5 years. So it's been there for about 2 years. And every time we take people on tours, you know, stand out there with a glass of water and pour it through and you can see what's happening. And they'll watch it and see how it weathers just like all the other streets that have been done under conventional terms. I mean, it's just like energy conservation. You know, using less is the cheapest new supply. So the same thing goes for stormwater. If we can reduce the amount that has to be treated and we don't have to build new capacity and amortize all that debt, then let's invest in the smarter alternative.
And was that their motivation, to reduce the treatment cost?
Absolutely. Because to put all of this new neighborhood on the grid, so to speak, would have just meant more pressure for more treatment capacity.
In an existing neighborhood, Stephen, one that's built out, what are the top two or three technologies that you used that can be used to make an existing neighborhood more sustainable?
You know, some of them are physical and they're about, you know, water and energy, but some of them are actually about social infrastructure. I think that there's as much to be gained by people, you know, working together on a tree planting project for this, you know, the street trees, or, you know, taking over a street end that doesn't need to be a big fat cul-de-sac, but can, you know, some of the pavement can be torn up and make it into a rain garden. You know, it's partly what you do physically, but also the working together part. And I think neighborhood sustainability is a lot more, there's a lot more to be tapped in terms of just the power of people working together and not just what's the, you know, the coolest design detail for a rain garden if you're going to dig up half a sidewalk and, you know, and plant trees in there. I mean, those are important things to do and there are lots of them. But I think that it's the give and take between people and looking for, you know, what's right in their neighborhood. You know, what are they looking for? Are they looking for more open space? Are they looking for traffic calming? Are they looking for a way to, you know, have a shared tool bank? Or is it just, you know, is it taking down the back fences and putting a path between backyards where they weren't smart enough to have an alley in the first place? You know, so it's going to be different everywhere. But I think it's as much people looking at what their challenges and what their opportunities are in their local situation. I think that's as much a powerful strategy as anything else.
What should we be legislating or requiring locally to achieve sustainability?
Ooh, that's too big a question.
Well, if you – okay, let me ask it differently. We make you in charge for a while. Tell me the first two or three things you're going to do.
Well, I would say one of the most important things is to stop making big city decisions based on cars.
Okay.
And that is just a pervasive mind change that has to be made, that just because there are a bunch of people stuck in traffic today doesn't mean there needs to be more road space, because we know that congestion doesn't go away when you build more road capacity. It's where are people trying to get to and where are they trying to be? The car doesn't do it. So that, I think, would be the first thing. And then I guess other than the transportation side, I think there's a real need to use good visualization techniques for people to understand livable urban density. And that means livable places, not necessarily dramatically different looking places, but understanding the importance of mixed use development, the importance of not having cars dominate design of neighborhoods. So it's separate from the whole roads thing. So I think there's a huge opportunity to work on livability based on healthy, vital mixing of uses. And that comes down to density, which of course is in a lot of American communities is a dirty word. And that's only because there have been so many bad designs of individual buildings, but not many smart designs of functional integrated neighborhoods.
Stephen, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Antupit is with Seattle-based architecture, design, and urban planning firm of Methuen. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Our sense of community and how we express ourselves in it are shaped by the connections we make with others. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith shares with us the passing of a great source of comfort and inspiration.
I am writing this commentary from my usual spot, surrounded by my usual sprawl of books and papers. It's a snug, comfortable hideaway where I can reflect and speak on things from my heart. But there's something missing from my untidy mess today that has broken my heart. It's my friend Fred, the gray tabby cat whose company my wife and I enjoyed for almost 18 years. Fred liked to creep over to the place I write, rub his head on my laptop so hard that the screen would fall flat, and then, with a sixth sense that defied all attempts at misdirection or relocation, plop down on the very notes I was using at that moment. When I would pick him up to move him, he would start purring with a loud, contented hum. I would put him next to me so that he could press himself close as hard as he could. Only after Fred got settled could I begin to write. This was our routine for every commentary I've written for this show. All of my thoughts have been nursed along by Fred's contented sighs and dream-twitching tail. But now I must carry on without him. Because this morning, the day I'm writing this, my wife Joy and I had to carry Fred to the vet to be put to sleep. It was painful, but renal failure left us no choice. Fred meant even more to Joy than to me. He was her constant companion. He kept her company every night for all the years that I've been on the road working. In fact, while making the bed today, it occurred to us that Joy has never slept a night without Fred in our current house of 11 years, and only 1 week in our prior house of 5 years when he was sick and had to stay with the vet on an IV. We will miss him dearly. Our grief is in direct proportion to the joy Fred brought us. Other than being impatient to be fed before 6 a.m., he made no demands and gave freely of love and laughter. For such a little creature, he filled up a lot of space. Our house seems smaller and quieter without him. I know that many of you understand. Surveys find that nearly all pet owners grieve for their pets, some so intensely that they become physically ill or unable to have another pet. The bonds that nourish our lives come no less from our pets than from other people. Indeed, it is our capacity for connecting with other creatures that attest to the best within us. There are many reported cases of people ignoring rescue, risk, or medical attention to be with their pets. This core of generosity for all beings, pets and people alike, is our humanity. Fred's legacy to me is a reminder of this, and of the hope that the best in us can find expression far more frequently. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.